Okay, good afternoon. So, today we're going to be continuing what we started when we talked about cache blocking. We're talking about how you write high performance code, knowing how the processor works, specifically how the cache works. And we're going to talk about some other ways of getting high performance after reviewing and talking about a few details of cache blocking. But first, some logistical notes. So we have some assignments on performance programming coming up, and these are going to work a little differently than prior assignments. So there's several things which are different. So one is that there's nothing to submit for the labs. The labs are just time for you to get help from TAs. The assignments are partners or individual. That's partners is two, not more than two. Or individual, your choice. If you have a partner, you and your partner must be able to attend a common lab time. It doesn't need to be the lab time you are registered for, but we don't want to find out that you need help in the assignment and then find out that when you talk to a TA, we need to play telephone with your other partner. You know, you say, oh, my partner did that part, and we talk to your partner, and your partner said, oh, my partner did that part, and we never actually get you help. So there are going to be two parts to the assignment. There's one submission in the Archimedes, but we'll have a separate grade for each part, and we will care that you have the first part submitted by that deadline, not the final deadline for the second part. That will be your grade for the first part. The first part is to rotate an image. So we'll have an image which is represented like the matrices we saw seen for our cache blocking examples, except instead of just numbers, it's pixels, which are red, green, and blue values. So the first part is going to be to rotate that, and the second part is going to be to smooth it, to take the average of a pixel and its surrounding pixels. And we will give you code which does this and is correct, and has timing code around it, and your job is to make a faster version of that that produces the exact same results. So our image representation, as I said, is an array like the ones we've seen. So we have this struct, which represents a pixel. It contains shorts. They might actually be unsigned shorts, but that would take up space on the slide. So red, green, and blue values. And you'll access them similar to this. And you'll see code in the assignment where, sorry, this got cut off, where we access elements using this funny RIDX thing. We'll get to that in a second. So the first part is rotate. So you're going to take an image that looks like this and make it look like this. If you were actually displaying it, you won't be. We're just going to care that you deal with the values correctly. And that's going to be a loop like this, where this is IJK. You can IJN, dim, sorry. But you can see the example code, which will have a correct implementation. And you just need to do the same thing that that does. So about this RIDX thing. So this is a preprocessor macro, which expands to the syntax we've seen in our cache blocking examples of I times N plus J, that sort of syntax based on I, J, N. But it's a preprocessor macro. So it looks like a function, but it's not a function. So as you might remember from learning C and C++ originally, we have pound include. And pound include just inserts the text of a file somewhere else. And this acts before the compiler gets to do anything. So it's like actually putting the text in the file. And these preprocessor macros are similar. So they look kind of like a function, but they expand to include the definition here, in this case, the thing that we specified, and a times and a two, before the compiler actually compiles any code. So this is a literal text substitution before we do the compilation step. It happens at the same time that pound includes are processed, and it's before we actually generate code. So it's not a function. And there's some subtleties with using macros, which is one reason we don't use them all the time. So one subtlety is that it really is text substitution. So if we do this, that's what it expands to. And that's even though that doesn't produce what you would think the answer should be. There's no parentheses in our value. There's no parentheses in the result. So it's 3 plus 3 times 2, which is not 3 plus 3, the quantity, times 2. This is a caution if you're writing macros. The other issue to be aware of is that if you have multiple copies of x, it's going to pure be evaluated multiple times. So they aren't functions in this sense. They really are just text substitutions. But the advantage of them over a function is that they are text substitutions. There's no function call. Yeah?
So if you wanted that to do what you would expect it to, you would add extra parentheses around the 3 plus 3?
So the question is, if I wanted this to do what I expected, I'd add extra parentheses around the 3 plus 3? Yes. And typically you do that in the macro itself rather than elsewhere. But you could also do it in the macro call. So typically, this is how you write macros when you're being careful. And you also, but you said if you have to evaluate the argument multiple times, it's still tricky. So Redux is just a macro which implements our x times n plus y. So it's a text substitution, so it doesn't generate a function call. So it's not a reason for your code to be slow by itself versus doing it out by hand. And I'm just telling you this so you can understand the code we're giving you, not because macros are an important part of this class. But it is a common thing you'll see in real C code, is using macros for various things. Okay, so any questions about Redux and macros and sort of the setup of these problems? Like the images? Okay, so as I said, you'll be producing faster variants of the code we give you. The template we're going to give you is going to let you take code for some implementation of rotate or smooth and make a copy of it and try both at the same time. And you can submit a file which has lots of variants, and we will time all of them subject to some limitations on the total amount of time I have to run them. But this means that, you know, you can have multiple variants, and you know, we'll give you the grade based on which one performs best overall. This is based on the timing code we'll give you, which is basically going to run your code versus our original implementation, see what the difference in timing is, and take the average across a bunch of sizes of images, and that's going to determine your grade. So one piece of advice is that when you're like tweaking your code and you have something that's good, you probably should make a copy of it to tweak, not tweak the original and then realize, oh, I made this lot slower. How do I go back? Just a discipline thing. So I mentioned that we'll be using speed up for grades. So in addition to having multiple variants, you know, you should worry about how they perform on my machine. That's where we'll be grading. The performance will vary between machines. It's generally going to be the case that if something's faster on your machine than something else, that the relative difference will also hold, maybe not the amount that it's faster by, but usually it holds. So you can look at results in your machine to get an idea, but the actual results and the details are based on what happens on my machine. To help you with this, we will have a web viewer for results on my machine, but this will be delayed because we're not going to just run everything when you submit it, especially if lots of people are submitting things. So you'll have to wait probably at least 5 minutes, maybe more than that if things are busy. But we'll have a web viewer for results, which will show you the results of each variant you submitted that got one. And we've set certain thresholds which are in the assignment. I might change the ones for the second part to be have the second threshold a little lower, but based on what I'm looking at. But what we look at to set these thresholds are, I have some implementation where I've done certain optimizations I think are reasonable for you to figure out, and I figured out what performance those got, and there's two numbers. So one is there's some optimizations where we think that's a 75%, and some we think is 100%. And these are just things that we know you can actually implement and are specific optimizations we think you should be able to find. That's how we set the rating thresholds. So any questions about any of the sort of logistics here? So general advice in these assignments. So our book and our lectures are going to mention lots of techniques for doing optimizations. You should just try things that seem applicable, see if they make things faster. You know, some of them won't be applicable to everything. For each of the two assignments, there is one technique, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. For each one, you have to figure that out by like reasoning about what they're doing. That is most important. That will like get you like 90 or 100% of the way there. Note that you may have to vary numbers. So if you do cache blocking with a very wrong block size, or some other techniques we'll talk about where you have to choose how many times to do something, you could get very bad performance. So for cache blocking, if you have a huge block size, well, that's the same as if you didn't cache block. If you have a really tiny block size, you might not be getting enough extra locality. So you might need to try multiple numbers. And that's normal. In general, for cache blocking in particular, like too big is going to be bad, and too small is going to be bad. But there's going to be a wide range of values which are pretty good. So like that you like 80% of your max performance you could get from cache blocking, and maybe you can get like an extra 10 or 20% by exactly tweaking the numbers. But most of your benefit is going to be getting kind of close enough. And maybe it's not worth the time to tweak those extra numbers. So something else I note about the assignment is that in the assignment we tell you that you can assume the sizes are a multiple of 32. You should take advantage of this. It will make things simpler for you, obviously, and for real code we probably wouldn't have that restriction, but a lot of the work to deal with like odd sizes when we're doing some of the optimizations we're talking about, like cache blocking, where when I was giving my examples, like I assume things were multiples of two. You know, there's extra work you can do to still work in those cases, but it's just tedious and not worth you doing. So that's meant to help you in the assignments, that you can assume they're multiples of 32. Any general questions, comments? Everyone's ready to start looking at the assignments sometime before they're due? Yeah. So with that, let's start by like reviewing briefly, since you probably forgot everything since the exam, our cache performance. So we talked about cache blocking. And our central idea was that we'd reorder accesses to memory to avoid cache misses. So in our matrix squaring example, when we were doing nothing, we're accessing everything about n squared times. And for all but one of the things, pretty much every one of those accesses would be a miss. For all but one of these three things in our inner loop. So that was with the naive sort of ordering. You know, we could choose which one of these things was usually a miss, but always one of them. So we had n squared misses. And what cache blocking let us do is that we would work on this block where we'd assume that in this, you know, inner loop, sort of the nested loop where we work on this k by j and I by j and I by k block of the bit of A, the two bits of A we need and the bit of B we need, that everything would be in the cache. And that means because we use bij, k times, we'd have n squared over k misses for the bijs, not n squared, and so on. So we got this big benefit based on our block size, based on reordering the accesses, so we have more cache hits because we were accessing things repeatedly more often. It wasn't perfect. Like, we still have a whole bunch of misses. We still need to access things, pull things into the cache multiple times, but it was a lot better. And sort of our central intuition was that in our innermost loop there, we would be taking a block of the parts of A we cared about and a block of the parts of B we cared about, and these should just fit in our cache. And sort of our ideal was that this would about use up all the cache we had, and that would probably give us about the best performance. So one way of thinking about it is that you're just planning some size of blocks and making that fit into the cache. Another way is that you're just improving the average locality by making compromises in the locality elsewhere. So previously, we might have had really good locality in AIK. Now we have slightly less good locality in AIK, but better locality in these other things. There are both ways of thinking about this optimization, cache blocking. So this gave us better spatial and temporal locality. And the best case, so if you're tuning cache blocking, the best case is that you about use up all the cache with it. That's approximately, like the details will differ, because for example, maybe you have to bring in stuff that isn't part of the blocks into the cache, because there's other stuff in the cache blocks that contain the elements. Maybe the cache replacement policy isn't perfect, and you have to have other stuff in the cache to not have misses. So it's not going to be exactly fitting in the cache, but it's going to be about there. That's where you should start if you're guessing what a good block size is. So I talked about cache blocking, and I may or may not have shown this picture briefly. So this is what I got when I took my matrix squaring example and implemented cache blocking. So originally, I got a decrease in performance. And then I made my loop faster in both the blocked and unblocked cases. And with the same sort of loop, I got an increase in performance. So what was happening here? So if you want to think about why this is happening, you should think about what we talked about, how out-of-order processors work and the data flow model. So why would there be a case where adding cache blocking actually hurt me if I had my loop not very good versus helping me if I had my loop was good? Yeah?
If you end up changing what's in cache more often, you're accessing memory, so it's going to make it take more. Like, yeah. If you're breaking up into chunks that are too small, you're switching what's in the cache really frequently.
So you're concerned that maybe my block size was very bad?
Yeah.
So that is a good concern to have, but I will assure you that in both of these cases, the block size choice was reasonable. But yes, that could be something which would cause this sort of problem. And if my block size choice was very bad, I'm adding extra loop operations, and maybe I have the same amount of badness in my locality. Just because, like, it still doesn't fit in the cache because I chose a very big block size or I chose a very small block size, so it didn't help very much versus the extra loop operations I added to track the, you know, block index and the other index. So any other ideas for, you know, assuming our block sizes are reasonable, what could be happening that causes this, you know, the optimized loop to be better for cache blocking than the unoptimized one? So if you remember, in our out-of-order processor, we have multiple things going on at once. So while we're doing a load, the processor can do other parts of the loop. So this is where you can have a problem. So our loads were slow, but not slow enough versus the unoptimized loop, or the under-optimized loop, I should say. So it turned out that those other operations we were doing in the loop took enough time that we didn't notice that our loads were getting shorter. It didn't matter that I made these loads on average shorter, because I was waiting on the multiplies and the adds and the other things that dealt with the loop operations and the actual arithmetic, because I was doing them in an inefficient way. So by speeding up the non-memory parts of the code, we started making the memory parts matter. And this is sort of a common phenomenon you'll see when you're trying to optimize the performance of something, is that, you know, there's some bottleneck. And until you fix that bottleneck, nothing else you do will matter. After you fix that bottleneck, everything else will start to matter. So you'll see this with other things. So if you optimize something, you know, and it doesn't make a difference now, doesn't mean it won't make a difference later when you fix some other performance problem in the code. And that was what was happening here. So it wasn't that my cache performance didn't matter, just didn't matter yet. It wasn't the cache was fast enough versus my inefficient arithmetic code. But it wasn't fast enough when I made the arithmetic code good. So any questions about sort of what happened here? So we're going to look mostly at ways we can do things like improve that loop performance. So we're going to move away mostly from cache optimizations and ways of avoiding cache misses, because cache blocking and loop order things are how you do that, and you should know that, hopefully. We'll review it if we need to. And we're going to talk about how we make that loop faster, the other part of our optimization. And both of these things are going to be complementary, because one of them can be the bottleneck or the other. But first, we're going to talk about the easiest way to do optimization, which is just to tell your compiler to do it. So what do compilers do? Because this is your most valuable tool in making fast code. And a lot of the time, they do everything you care about. And we're going to focus on things that they don't do so well. So to do that, we're going to need to know when do compilers work well and when don't they. I'm going to start by talking about what compilers do by default. So here's what happens if I compile some assembly with GCC without any optimizations enabled. Just do GCC minus capital S, no other flags. This is the sort of output I get. So this is pretty hideous from a performance point of view. So we are storing this sum here, the result here, on the stack, which we're accessing through the frame pointer. So we're using the frame pointer and the stack pointer, so we've lost a register. Not that we use it, because we're also accessing I on the stack, and then immediately moving it to compare it right afterwards, and also keeping N on the stack. Even though we have plenty of registers left over. So this is the sort of code compilers generate when you don't ask for any optimizations. And you say, I would never write assembly like this. Well, you wouldn't. But the compiler needs a systematic way to generate code. And you know, it might run out of registers. So the simplest thing to do when you're implementing a compiler is you start from the point where every local variable is on the stack. And when you do an operation, you just load all the variables you need into registers, do the operation, store everything back to the variables. That's the simplest way to implement a compiler. And that's what this assembly code is showing. That every time we need a variable, we load it from its place in memory, which is either on the stack or through a pointer or through a global variable, into a register, do that single operation, then put everything back in variables as needed. And this avoids problems with like running out of registers. But it's obviously not the code you want to generate. So if you turn on any optimizations, compilers will do smarter things. So we can look at the optimized version of this. So this is me running GCC with the dash capital O lowercase s, which stands for optimize for size. And as you might guess from the name, it produces small code. You have this nice small implementation, and this is more like what you'd write. So here, we're keeping everything in registers. We're using a single instruction to get at the appropriate index of the array using this complex addressing form. We have a logical increment instruction instead of like going to the stack and adding and all that. We have a compare instruction at the top of the loop that doesn't do anything funny with things on the stack. So this looks like pretty straightforward. So this is more like what you expect. And the compiler is capable, as long as you ask it, of doing the usual things of generating assembly that makes reasonable use of registers and doesn't do stupid things with keeping values on the stack and moving them back and forth and all that. This is one example of what an optimizing compiler produces. And most compilers have lots of optimization options. And it's not really clear exactly what they do differently, but they have lots of options for how they're going to optimize code, and they'll probably generate different code in different cases. And that's going to be true pretty much all the time. And so your performance is going to vary based on the exact optimization flags, and you might see rather different code based on what the compiler decides will make this code fast. So for example, GCC with -02 for optimization level 2, which is probably a good normal default if you want to generate good code from GCC and you don't care about how large that code is. It generates this for the loop. So this is a bit weirder. So it does some extra tricks here. So the biggest thing it's doing is we see we're adding 8. We're not incrementing, we're adding 8. And why 8? Because 8 is the size of a long. So part of optimizing this loop is that rather than have this complex add instruction here, which has the comma 8, which is going to take a little longer for the processor to handle, we actually keep track of a pointer to the current array element and increment it by the size of an array element. And this is a transformation that compilers are actually very good at doing. And probably better than you would be at doing consistently and not messing up. So you see that's what the compiler did here. So it adds 8 to advance the pointer, it's keeping track of a pointer, and it got a pointer to the end of the array, and that's what it's doing with the comparison on. It has this little extra setup code here where it takes care of 0 and otherwise computes the end of the array and does the normal loop, which also meant that it got to move the comparison to the end of the loop instead of the beginning, which we learned is a little faster because it has one conditional jump instruction instead of a jump instruction and a conditional jump instruction. And you can see, as will be a common theme today, that GCC generated code which is probably faster by making it longer. So we have more code here because we're doing this add 8 trick, which is probably faster, but we have all this extra setup code to make that work. And there's a lot of things we're going to talk about which make our code bigger to make things faster. And cache blocking was an example. We certainly made those loops much more complex in order to get that speed improvement. And lots of other things which are not focused on the cache are going to have the same sort of aspect, that we're going to make slightly larger code to get some faster code. So you've seen an example of all the sorts of clever things that GCC does with a very simple function. And you know, this is nice. You don't have to think about turning things into pointers. Compiler will do it for you. You don't have to think about converting your for loops into do while loops to get that extra efficiency of missing that jump. The compiler will do it for you, as long as you tell it to. But compilers and you are good at different kinds of optimizations. In particular, the compiler has some limits which are going to keep it from doing optimizations which might be really obvious to you. And we're going to talk about several of these. So one of these is that the compiler needs to generate code that actually does the same thing. So this doesn't seem like an actual limitation. But the big reason this matters is that when you look at code, there are corner cases when you look at, that you don't consider, that obviously no one would ever use this function that way. The compiler can't say that. The compiler needs to generate code which literally does exactly what the standard says it should do, exactly what the C language says, even if it's a ridiculous way to call this function. We'll see an example of that next. So the other big compiler limitation is that it's limited in scope. So usually when a compiler does optimizations, it does it about a method at a time. Sometimes it will look between methods, and very rarely it will look between separate .o files, but usually it won't do this. So this means that if you expect the compiler to optimize something by looking between functions, where you have to look in one function to see how it uses another function to do it, that's unlikely to happen. It sometimes will happen, but usually the compiler won't figure that out. And there's reasons for this. So one is that looking a method at a time is more efficient for the compiler, and you know, you might not like how long it takes to compile things now, and would take a lot longer if the compiler looked between methods all the time. And the other is between files, you want to compile to assembly before you know what any of the other functions are. So you just don't have the information. The compiler doesn't know. So other things which limit the compiler is the compiler doesn't know what's important in your code. The compiler doesn't know, is this loop going to be something that's going to be executed 1,000 times or 3? So it can't decide, do I need to make the case where this loop is executed lots of times fast, or the case where this loop is executed like 3 times fast? It also doesn't understand what your notion of a trade-off between code size and speed is. Like, do you care if the compiler makes your function take up 10 kilobytes if it makes it really fast? Or are you going to be really unhappy that why is my executable 1 megabyte big and most of the code is not stuff I ever run? You know, the compiler needs to make a conservative choice on that, and it's probably going to choose to do something which doesn't make things incredibly big, even if that might make things a lot faster, if it's not sure that that's a trade-off you really want. So these are sorts of general limitations, which are why compilers are not going to always do a great job compared to humans. So I'm going to talk with or from a specific example of doing the same thing, even in weird corner cases that don't matter. And our book has this example of the biggest problem of this sort, which is aliasing. So here we have a function twiddle, and it adds what py points to twice to px. And a logical way that you might try to implement this is by loading px, loading py, then multiplying it times 2 by adding it to itself, and then storing that and adding that to px. That would be a logical way to implement this. It is also not correct. It's a logical thing to do. It takes up, it's much faster than the direct implementation of loading py twice and writing to px twice. You know, you avoid 2 whole cache accesses. We also avoid some additions. It's definitely a bit benefit to do this sort of optimization, but we can't do it. The compiler can't do it because I could call the function with the same pointer twice. You might say, no one would ever use this function this way. You'd probably be right. But the compiler can't make that assumption. It needs to generate code which still works in that case. So if it wants to do this sort of thing, where we load a value once and double it, it needs to first check, are the two pointers equal or not? It could do that, but that's also extra time. It's also going to be slow. It also needs to know how to do that. So this makes sense why we're missing an optimization opportunity here. So because the compiler can only look at this function alone, it has no idea whether px and py print are the same thing. This is also a case where it matters that we can't look between methods. Because in between methods, maybe the compiler could figure out, oh, those are different variables that this point to. But when it's just implementing this method alone, can't do that. So this example looks very contrived. Like, maybe this doesn't really come up in real programs. You know, maybe this is not actually a common thing. And unfortunately, it's not. It is a contrived example, but the problem is not. So I'm going to give a more realistic example of aliasing, which is a bit more subtle, and where it's a bit more obvious that you shouldn't need to worry about aliasing here. So in this case, we have one implementation here which has aliasing problems, and one which doesn't. So in this one where we have aliasing problems, the compiler is going to be worried that result of row and matrix of row times n plus col might be the same thing at some point. And this is because we could call SumRows 1, where result and matrix are pointers to different parts of the same array. Now that would be crazy, but the compiler doesn't know you're not doing that. It has to generate code which does the right thing, even if you do that. So that means that the compiler can't keep this result row in this inner loop in a register. It needs to store it every time you update it. Because it's worried that you might be modifying one of the matrix elements you're reading in the future. So you'll see that there's a trick we can do here, which is generally the solution to aliasing problems, which is to use a local variable. When there's this local variable here, the compiler knows, well, modifying sum can't possibly change anything in matrix. And it knows that because there's no pointers to sum anywhere in the program. It's not possible for there to be a pointer to sum. And this is our usual solution to an aliasing problem. So when you write code like this, the compiler will say, OK, I can put sum in a register. I don't need to write to memory all the time in this inner loop. And it will, in fact, generate better code, which will perform better. So the blue line is the first version. The green line is the second version. So just by adding this useless variable, we told the compiler enough about aliasing not happening that it generated better code. And it couldn't have done that before because it couldn't have figured out that result and matrix weren't parts of the same array. I note that getting rid of aliasing also can help the compiler more than this. So for example, on my system, if I use O3, this is the difference in performance. So something extra happened. And what happened here is that knowing that these things did an alias with the more aggressive optimization level allowed the compiler to do something that made more assumptions about whether things were accessing memory or not. So this will often be the case that when you eliminate aliasing, you'll let the compiler do more for other reasons, just because it has more freedom to do funny things with the order of this loop. Like it can realize that, iterations of this loop are actually independent of each other and things like that, which it can't figure out here when it's worried that every iteration of the loop might write to memory where we're about to read from memory. Okay. So aliasing, yeah, so our general solution is going to be use local variables. That's going to tell the compiler, no aliasing problems here. Okay. So I showed you an example of aliasing with sort of ring update. I note that there's an interaction between aliasing and our cache optimizations. So if you were thinking about when we were talking about, for example, loop orders, you might say, well, couldn't the compiler figure out what the best loop order is for me? Or couldn't the compiler even do cache blocking for me? And aliasing is one of the biggest reasons why probably not. Maybe it could, but aliasing makes it really hard. So in this case, for example, why do I have two copies of the same thing? I suppose I went to reorder them. I definitely meant to reorder these. But if B and A are equal, then the compiler can't reorder this loop. If B is like a pointer to 10 elements into A, it really can't do that. And that's the sort of possibilities the compiler needs to worry about. And because of that, the compiler has basically no freedom to reorder these nested loops. So it can't do the cache blocking optimizations for us unless it figures out that B and A don't overlap, or it decides to insert an explicit check that they don't overlap, which is not something that compilers will commonly do. They could, it's not common. So this is the reason why we did all our cache blocking manually, because the compiler doesn't know enough about B and A to actually figure out that it's a safe optimization, even if it had a good enough model of what would hit or not hit in the cache. So one thing we're doing when we're getting rid of aliasing is we're getting rid of redundant loads. This is another way to view what problem we're solving with aliasing. It's that normally our compiler gets rid of redundant loads for us and redundant stores. So like normally we'd expect that when we access result row repeatedly, we don't reload it every time and we don't restore it every time. That we keep it in a register until we're done. We don't keep loading it and storing it. And aliasing is an example of something where redundant loads are a problem the compiler can't get rid of. That if you're accessing something multiple times, but there might be aliasing, the compiler needs to worry, maybe it just changed because of this other thing, other pointer access nearby. And this will be cases where compiler will keep loading it over and over again. And even if it hits cache every time, this is still slower because accessing cache is going to be slower on a modern processor than accessing a register. This was even true on the one you implemented because accessing memory required an extra instruction, which is slower. But also on a modern processor, it's still true. Accessing cache is going to be slower than accessing a register. So the compiler does this by itself when it knows aliasing isn't a problem. And this you can think of as what the real benefit of telling the compiler about aliasing is that we're removing redundant loads and stores. And this comes up all the time when we have loops, especially that like manipulate arrays. So here, there's some sort of redundant load happening. Can someone tell me what it is? There's some redundant operation where, especially given aliasing, our compiler is going to load a value over and over again from cache, even though we could avoid doing that pretty easily. Yeah? So you're thinking it's bim plus j. So it's true that we load bim plus j for every I and j k times. The problem is that we load it on the first iteration of the, for I equals 0 and 0, we load on the first iteration of each of these outermost loops. So we don't do it right next to each other, so they probably actually don't hit in cache. And we can't easily keep a value, copy of the value around in a register and read it because it's not going to be for the right I and j. Yeah?
We're probably loading a of I times n plus k.
Yeah. So the big one is this A of I times M plus K. And this is the one where we have the best temporal locality, the one that's kept in cache the best. And we load this every iteration of the loop through J. And it's the exact same value. I and K don't change. So we're reading the exact same memory location over and over again. And if the compiler knew that B and A didn't alias, it would generate code which loads this once, maybe. But it doesn't know that, so it's definitely going to load it every single time. And that's going to be slower than if we put it in a register and read from that register over and over again. So the same way that I put the sum variable for the that sum rows function in a in its own variable, so it could be in a register, I can put this AI times M plus K in a variable. So this is basically the same, but now I have this variable to represent a of I times n plus k, just to help out the compiler. I'm telling the compiler, yeah, you should probably keep this in a register, and this is how I'm giving it that hint. And by telling it this way, it knows that aliasing is not a problem, that it should just keep the same value it reads before this loop and reuse it over and over again. So if I do this, the compiler will most likely keep AIK in a register and generate code that's a bit faster. We'll have less memory reads, less instructions to run. And if you think about cache blocking, we actually have many more redundant loads that we could do this sort of transformation to. So we'd really like to, since we're accessing BIJ multiple times, we'd really like to actually do this transformation for that. But we couldn't do it because we have too many of them. It's not going to fit in the register. But when we do cache blocking, we get closer to a situation where we can handle that. So let's look at the situation where we've done the sort of the first step we did of cache blocking, of blocking in K, was just two iterations of each. So here, we're accessing two things repeatedly. We're accessing bij for the specific I and j repeatedly. And we're accessing aik for one I and two different values of k repeatedly. So you have three different values that we're accessing over and over again. And we can apply that transformation to all of them. So first, we can do it for bij. We can say, we're going to load bij before this loop and store it afterwards. And avoid reloading it every time, restoring it every time, just not have these redundant operations. And this hint of using a local variable will tell the compiler, you don't have to worry about aliasing. Please try to keep this in a register. And we can do the same sort of thing with these AIKs, but it's a little trickier because there's two different Ks. So how do we do that? Well, the easiest way is to just expand the loop. So I just wrote out the loop, which was k plus 0, k plus 1. I just expanded out the loop explicitly and then pulled out these common variables that we access every iteration of this j loop. And when I do this, this makes it easy for the compiler to keep these two aik elements in registers. And that's going to hopefully make our code faster because we'll be reading from the cache a lot less. Even though all those reads would be cache hits, you know, it's still better not to even use the cache. So, yeah?
In this example, you're not helping yourself out with bij, right? It's still inside the loop, so you're still doing.
So the question in this example, we're not helping with bij. So we're still getting a little benefit for bij in this example. Because before, we'd actually have to store it after this first plus equals. Because we'd worry that this access to A might be to the same address. Even though that's wildly unlikely to happen. But the compiler would be worried about that, so we'd actually still have an extra store. So if we take this technique and apply it to everything, and like just with cache blocking, we did the other variables and kept going, you get code that looks something like this. Not very pretty. But often makes the compiler generate more efficient code. So in this code, we have eight variables, which are temporary copies of values we're using. And this sort of what you can think of saying is that we want you, compiler, to use registers for all of these eight variables. And we know you have eight registers. Please use them. That's what we were trying to say with this code. And by giving the compiler this explicit hint, we can make the compiler do this, even though aliasing would make it hard for it to figure it out by itself. So this idea is often called register blocking, because it's kind of like cache blocking, but instead of keeping things in the cache, we're keeping them in registers. And just like with cache blocking, we need to kind of tell the compiler, here's the pattern I want you to use to do that. So any questions about this sort of ugly piece of code here? Yeah.
So like at a certain point, though, you don't want to keep doing that because you only have so many registers, right? So like beyond like 10 or so.
Yeah. So the question is, at a certain point, you don't want to do this because you'll run out of registers. Absolutely. Yeah. If I have too many variables, I'll probably make the compiler read the value from A or B, then put it on the stack, then put it back in a register, then put it on the stack, then put it back in a register, and so on. And I'll end up with slower code. There's some point where doing this won't help you. But as long as it helps you use more registers, it probably will help you. So we saw our general strategy, just for aliasing and the sort of general problem of not having redundant loads, is to create a variable to tell the compiler, there's no aliasing here, and really, you should keep this in a register. Because the compiler is going to try to keep local variables in registers. It also tries to keep other things in registers, but aliasing means it often won't figure out how to. But for local variables, it's easy for it to know there's no aliasing. So this is us communicating better with our compiler. So there's also a more explicit way to do this. So there's a keyword called restrict in C. This is relatively new. And this is something you can put on a pointer, which says, I promise you, this pointer does not alias another pointer. And if it does, it's undefined behavior. Sorry. So the compiler won't tell you anything. It will just generate wrong code if it does. And you can think maybe this will help the compiler do the optimization itself. So I note that this is a funny keyword because it applies to pointers. So this is actually the syntax for saying B is a restrict pointer. Yes, it appears after the star. So maybe this would let the compiler do the optimization itself. In practice, I haven't seen this be effective very often, but in theory, it should help. Yeah, in practice, I don't know that compilers are very good at using this hint, basically. So that talk about some other issues with our cache blocking code. So one thing you may notice about our cache blocking code, which seems actually pretty bad, is that not only are we doing the multiply of two floating point values here, but we're also doing two multiplies to compute the array index. And then shifting the value over. That seems awfully slow. Lots of multiplies every iteration of the loop. You know, could we do better? And it turns out, yeah, you can. So you could keep a pointer to some element of A and increment it in your inner loop by n. Because we previously were multiplying I times n. Here we're adding n to the pointer every time we increment I. So it's equivalent. So this is a transformation you can do to simplify that. But you generally don't have to. The compiler will usually figure this out. So most of the time, if you have code that does I times n and plus plus I in a loop, the compiler will transform it to code which keeps an I times n variable and does I times n plus equals n. Usually just automatically. So the reason I'm mentioning this issue is because it doesn't always do this. And it's really confusing when it doesn't. Because you'll have code where the compiler did this, and then you change the loop so the compiler can't figure this out anymore. And suddenly your loop is way slower. And sometimes the reason for that is that the compiler didn't do this transformation anymore. It didn't figure out that your loop worked that way. And when that happens, the fix is to just do it yourself. But obviously, if the compiler is already doing it yourself is not going to help. In fact, it might make things a little worse. This also will help you maybe understand better if you look at the assembly code the compiler generates, because this is a common thing the compiler is really good at doing to loops, even though it's pretty tricky for humans to figure it out as easily. But compilers are really good at figuring it out. Any questions about this transformation? Do it? Okay. So that's sort of my redundant load, sort of kind of cache-related optimizations, but it's really more about never using the cache ever. The next step beyond cache blocking. And also making sure address computation isn't crazy. So I'm going to look into sort of more, things that are not about big arrays and things like that, about smaller pieces of code. We're going to talk about things which are mostly affected by these two issues. So one is that compilers don't optimize across methods, and the other is that the compiler is going to make a conservative choice about whether to make your code bigger. And one big case when this comes up is when you have nice little utility functions. So here, I have this sumWithLimit function. And sumWithLimit, you know, does something pretty simple. It adds two numbers, checks if they're greater than something, and it says, so puts 10,000. And if the compiler is not looking across functions, it's just going to generate a normal function call for this. And that's going to look something like this. So we move the array element into the argument register. We move our sum counter to the appropriate argument register and do a call. And then in sum with limits, we're going to do our computation, put the result in EAX, and then do a return. So we've actually executed four extra instructions to do this. We have these two move instructions, the call instruction, and the return instruction. And two of those instructions access the cache, call and return. Well, extra accesses the cache. So that's slower than we need to be. So, you know, in this case, you know, we could have just put the function right in the loop. And maybe the compiler could do that too. And that would probably be faster because this function was so simple. So this is called function inlining because we're making it inline in the thing that calls it. And it's a fairly simple transformation that you can do by hand if the compiler doesn't do it for you. And it seems like something the compiler could do. And the reasons the compiler isn't doing it have to do more with the compiler's reluctance to look across functions and its worry about making your code really big. If we always inline functions, we'd end up with really, really big code. And that would be a problem because we'd like not only have inconveniently large executables, we'd run out of instruction cache space, and our program would end up being slower, especially if the function we were inlining wasn't used very much. Just wasting space. So inlining has these big advantages that we not only get rid of those extra instructions to set up the arguments, we also free up some registers because we don't have to worry about call or save registers anymore. But the compiler won't just automatically do it because sometimes it hurts your performance. When you have a big function you're inlining in another function, you're going to make your program a lot bigger. That bigger program's going to take up more space in the instruction cache. Often that will make your program slower. Sometimes it won't. Depends on how important that function is, how much avoiding these extra overhead matters. So the compiler will take a conservative guess about doing things that are going to make your program faster, most likely. And to do that, there's usually about two important heuristics the compiler uses. So it's going to inline functions if they're very small. So we'll do this, but only if the functions are very small. So it's sure that there should be enough benefit in performance that it's worth the extra code size. If they're larger than some pretty small threshold, it's not going to bother. It's going to assume not worth it. I don't know that this is called enough, that it's going to be worth the extra space in the executable. Also, they'll have some extra heuristics, like if a function is called exactly once, it might inline it that case, because that doesn't increase the code size. You can have exactly one copy of the function and get rid of the other copy that you would call. So the other restriction is compilers usually don't inline across .o files. This is just because a .o file already contains the assembly code, and you need to do a lot of extra work to actually inline across .o files. This is not universal, but you usually have to do extra things to convince your compiler to do that, because it means linking is different than it used to be. I note that some compilers, including GCC, do have ways of giving hints where you can say, hey GCC, this function, it's really important, you should always inline it, trust me. Or you can say, GCC, this function, really not worth inlining, never inline it, please. These are not standard C, but they might be handy if you're actually optimizing code by hand rather than inlining directly. So you can always just copy the function into the function that calls it to do this transformation when the compiler's heuristics say, I shouldn't inline here. So any questions about function inlining? And I'm surprisingly ahead of the other class, but that's okay, I guess. Okay, so function inlining, so this is something that you will do manually just because often these heuristics aren't going to be right, just because, you know, your compiler is assuming, like, maybe this function is called, like, three times, because it doesn't know how many times the loop is called. Maybe it's not important, not worth the extra size. Maybe you don't care so much if you have a megabyte executable, but the compiler thinks you do. Because you don't have like a precise way of saying, this is how much I care about how big my executable is. So the compiler just doesn't make the right choices for you. Okay. So for the rest of today and next time, we'll talk mostly about loops. So loops are one of the most important targets of optimizations. Because, well, they're where a program spends most of their time. And there are specific sort of optimization techniques that we can apply by hand, and our compiler can sometimes apply, but has the same sorts of restrictions we talked about earlier of not knowing when you care about larger code, not knowing what the inputs actually are, you know, about corner cases. So one thing to think about with loops that's particularly important when we talk about optimizing them is that if we take this straightforward implementation of this simple loop, most of our instructions here are loop maintenance. None of these instructions I have highlighted do any useful work. Like they're all about the index variable, doing the comparisons, jumping around. So we have five instructions in our loop, and four of them don't do anything useful besides make sure the loop works correctly. You know, so we have this one actual useful instruction. And the big idea we're going to have when optimizing loops, the biggest one is getting more out of these loop maintenance instructions. And the easiest way of doing that is to have more do more work per iteration of the loop. So this is the technique known as loop unrolling, because what we're going to do is we're going to do the same amount of incrementing and comparing, but we're going to do more of this work operation each iteration. So what we'll end up with is instead of doing one add, we'll do two adds. And in exchange, we'll add two to RDX instead of incrementing it. There's a little bit of a detail we need here, which is that this is not the same. This doesn't produce the same answer. And that's because what if ESI is not a multiple of 2. Doesn't produce the same answer in that case. So in this case, we need extra code. So we're going to need some extra code I'm not showing to handle the leftover. If ESI isn't a multiple of 2, we need to actually make that case work. So we need extra code to make that happen. And we also, you know, have extra code in general because, well, we've gone from 5 instructions to 6 instructions here. So we've actually made our program bigger to do this. Now, it clearly seems like this should be worthwhile because executing this add and this compare and this branch probably take an actual time. And it will be, but that's our cost here. This is why the compiler might not do this for us. Because we're adding a whole bunch of extra code And this code is in fact pretty useless if our loop is executed like with n equals 3. Yeah. If n equals 3, what we're doing here is we have the extra setup code to deal with ESI being odd, the extra code afterwards to deal with the leftover stuff, and some additional instructions otherwise. We've actually spent more time. And we've gotten no benefit from having a larger program. And we might have even made it slower overall, because of even ignoring this loop, because of making the instruction cache have more pressure. But if we know this loop is executed lots and lots of times, this is clearly a win. So when the compiler doesn't figure this out for you, when it decides it's not worth unrolling this loop, or it decides it's not worth unrolling this loop as much as you'd like to do it, you can do it by hand. So you can write this in C. So this is our general template. We're doing loop unrolling, which is that, you know, we just, instead of incrementing by one, we increment by two, we access each of the elements, and then we have to handle the leftover, assuming there is any. And I note that on our performance assignments, as I mentioned, I think that we guarantee you that the sizes are multiples of 32. You should take advantage of this, because it will simplify things because of things like this. This code you don't have to write. Okay, and I think that's where I'll stop for today to keep kind of in sync with the other class.